The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston. I will be your guest host for this shortened Trumpet Daily. We're just pre-recording the first 10 to 15 minutes of today's show. Like Mr. Flurry promised earlier this week, we'll play our interview with Israeli historian Gadi Taub on the rest of the show. It's about a 40 to 45 minute interview. We just landed in England maybe about half an hour, 45 minutes ago. And we are pre-recording, like I said, just the beginning of today's show to lead into this interview. I thought I would, just in this little period of time, just kind of give you some of the background details on how this interview came about and just on Gadi in general. Again, we have been in Israel. We were in Israel the last week. Now we're stopping over in Edstone as we make our way back to our headquarters campus in Edmond. As you've seen on the show, we interviewed Michael Oren, and he was the interview that we had scheduled heading into the trip going to Jerusalem, and we were hoping to get a few more interviews. Like Mr. Flurry said, we toured the area of or around Gaza following the October 7 attack, and in the meantime, we'd been trying to line up some other interviews, myself and Brent Nagtegal. We were emailing some others, trying to get in contact with some people while we were in Israel. Brent had been emailing Carolyn Glick, and we'd been trying to set up an interview with her. We were also hoping that we could interview Ron Dermer. Both of them, we had a bit of email contact with, but they're working for Benjamin Netanyahu as advisors. So we weren't able to get interviews with them because right as we arrived in Israel, they went on their big trip, Netanyahu and his entourage, over to Washington, D.C. But it worked out that Brent Nagtegal had been trying to reach out to this gentleman named Gadi Taub. And then he asked Carolyn, well, since you're not in the country, and she did respond, which is just awesome to think about having that contact and how close she is to Netanyahu. She did respond and recommended some other people that we could get in contact with for an interview. And Gadi Taub was one of these individuals. Gadi, he's an Israeli historian. I think he'll mention in the interview that he studied American history in the United States. He just became very interested in the United States and what it represented in the grand scheme of Western civilization and in world history. And he mentions there again that this was something that's not taught in Israel. He's also a pretty popular podcast host in Israel, just as a conservative there. And there aren't many of them in Israel. We were talking to Melanie Phillips, and she's, again, in many ways a lone voice over there. And Gadi Taub is as well. There aren't many people that have a pretty strong conservative view over there. So as we were working to get this interview set up, Brent was texting Gadi, and he agreed to do this interview with us. I believe it was on Tuesday. And so we drove off to Tel Aviv. Again, there were just a few things that kind of just seemed like, well, this was going to be a pretty good and important interview for us. Even just driving there, it was a bit stressful, the amount of traffic that was piling up, and then it just seemed like there were things that were getting in the way of what ended up being a really good interview and contact for us. Just as we walked in the door to Gadi's apartment, he mentioned to us that he was texting Lee Smith, and we said, oh, well, yeah, Lee Smith has been to our campus. I'd actually just emailed him a couple weeks prior. And Gadi he asked if he could take a picture of Mr. Flurry to send to Lee Smith and say, hey, look who I'm with right now. So that was a neat little just behind the scenes detail to see that work out. Like I said, there aren't many voices conservative that are really pro-Israel now. So it is becoming a closer knit circle. It was already a tight-knit circle over there in Israel, but now it's getting even closer and even smaller. Gadi has a really neat history with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Bibi has been on Gadi's podcast before, and then he was mentioning how following some health advice that Bibi had gotten, that he needed to go out and walk more. And Prime Minister Netanyahu invited Gadi Taub to go out for a walk. And just, I think he explains, he might say it in the interview, just some of the details about that interaction. If not, he was talking about how it's just the Secret Service, I don't know what they call it in Israel, and how they would trail them as they were going for this walk, and a lot of the details, just so that they could walk together. So it is neat to see that Netanyahu has reached out to him in this way. And it is probably pretty lonely for Bibi up at the top. He doesn't have a lot of, you know, supporters in the media. So to be able to sit down with Gadi Taub was a great opportunity for the Trumpet Daily, for Mr. Fleury. Gadi he used to have a podcast with Carolyn Glick. I think they both shared that. He's written for Tablet magazine, which also Lee Smith writes for, and then he's written for Jewish News Syndicate. Just reading a few of the notes here that Brent wrote up for us. Well, I'm sorry, I did just go through all of that with you. I apologize. We just got off the plane not long ago. I wanted to give you some of the background details to set up this interview. I think I've gotten through most of what I wanted to get through for you here. Let me just have a look. Yes, I think I've covered most of that for you. So we'll lead into that. I thought I would mention, we didn't get through much news, obviously, leading into this show. Make sure you check out the morning brief from Mr. Palmer. Keep up with the Trumpet website. Follow us on Twitter as well. There's the SEP camp that's going on right now at headquarters. The PCG Twitter account has a lot of updates for you there. And then keep up with us on the Trumpet Daily tomorrow, where is another travel day for us. Hopefully Mr. Fleury will be able to record something before we leave to set up the interview with Melanie Phillips. But for now, you can enjoy the interview that we had with Israeli historian Gadi Taub.
Gadi Taub, people are very familiar with you here in Israel. You've got a growing audience internationally as well. But for those in our audience who aren't familiar with you, maybe you could just start by explaining what you do and how you came about becoming a political commentator.
Yeah, accidentally, actually. Politics here are so intense that they just suck you in. I started as a children's TV host. I did that for many years, and then I wrote a book about my generation's culture, claiming that the postmodern trend in Israel is going to end in a dead end. And that got me in a lot of heat with my peers, because I was also writing fiction, so they saw it as a bit of a betrayal, my criticism of that. And after I wrote this book, which is nonfiction, and it was after a few books of fiction, it was surprisingly successful. I thought I should pursue an academic career, and I thought all strands lead to America, all the political influence, postmodernism, art, everything leads to America. But nobody studies America and Israel, because we buy the American mistake about themselves, the Americans' mistake about themselves, as if America is not, as if America is generic, just pragmatic, it just offers solution, the Constitution is good for everyone. And so people don't take American ideas seriously. Sadly, a lot in America too, but in Israel certainly. And that's what interested me. And then I went to do a PhD in American history at Rutgers. And I think I came back with a lot of insights helpful about the context here, and got a job in academia. And then the podcast revolution came. I did a few screenplays in between and a lot of other things, but then politics here are so intense, and the rift between elites and the masses are so intense that I couldn't stay out of that quarrel. And I come from the heart of the elite. And again, I'm a traitor to them, because my book, my recent nonfiction book, is roughly translated. It's not a translation of the title, just the content. Globalist Elites and National Citizens. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the rift everywhere in democracies now. And I think Israel's elite has become hostile to democracy. And like other elites, only more so, entrenched itself in a bureaucracy, in the judiciary, in the army, and it's blocking the way to democracy. And the apex of this is the Netanyahu trial. It's the deep state versus democratic politics. And in a sense, it's exactly the story in America, right? It's a Trump, unlike people try to portray him, I think Batya Unger-Sargon is exactly right, is the American working class hero. The hero of the deplorables, and the attempt to say, oh, he's a billionaire. Well, he's a billionaire, but his agenda is the agenda of the working class, of the deplorables, of national unity. And when people say, oh, that's identity politics, I say no, because it is the elites that detach themselves from the great mass of national citizens. So it's not a Marxist interpretation. And here I part from Batya because I'm not on the left. But I think that these leaders, Netanyahu, Trump, they represent the common people and their strong sense of patriotism. And we need to rehabilitate that, because democracy does not survive without national solidarity. If there is no sentiment of patriotism connecting you to a common community, then you just use your vote for egotistic, short-range aims. You'd vote for only your private passions, and so democracy depends on this on rehabilitating solidarity, and this is why identity politics come from elites. They come from elites which are trying to fragment this large body of national solidarity.
This article you did a few months ago, a deep state doesn't get any deeper than this. I was telling you before we started the cameras that it was striking, the parallels between what's, you kind of alluded to a moment ago, but the parallels between the deep state in America, which is kind of complicated to understand, and then when I read about it in Israel, that's too much for me to even process.
People don't believe that. It's like, yeah. it sounds completely crazy.
Maybe you could summarize, you know, in your view, what the deep state is and how it's been attacking Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, there's, you know, with every arena, there is a special story. There's a story to the American quarrel between elites and the masses. Is this and the deep state? There's a story in Hungary. There's a story in the European Union in general, and there's a story in Israel, and it's specific everywhere. So the Israeli variant begins with Labor losing power. I remember that my father was the Secretary General of the Bank of Israel, and then the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and he was a Labor man. And then Likud came, and everybody here says Likud doesn't know how to rule. It left the labor bureaucracy. That's true, except in the case of my father. They fired him. So I remember that traumatically. As a child, when Likud came in, my father was ousted. He stayed in the public service. He didn't want to go into business because he was a pioneer and an idealist and lost a hand in the War of Independence and so forth. So a very committed patriot. But when labor lost power, it began to shift the centers of decision-making outside of electoral politics and into the bureaucracy, and especially the Supreme Court. And there they had the luck, we had the misfortune of that process meeting the wild ambitions of a judge. I think Richard Posner called Aharon Barak is his name. He called him a judicial buccaneer who just grabbed power however he could. And he basically Marbury versus Madison asked to death. If you imagine John Marshall to the power of 10, then you get near to where Barak is. And gradually they elevated the attorney general to a veto over government policy, because the attorney general is also the legal counsel for the executive. And what they did here, and this it's very hard to explain to people that it's true, it's not crazy. The legal counsel, his advice is obligatory according to the Supreme Court. So you cannot disobey your legal counsel. Now the government is trying to fire her, and the Supreme Court is apparently going to block that. So you basically have an unelected single official who can veto government policy and also indict the prime minister and the ministers. And when a minister of justice came in, who is also a professor of jurisprudence, well respected worldwide, Daniel Friedman, and before him another minister of justice, so this was not for the first time, said, we have to separate the two. You can't have someone being the solicitor for the government and also the prosecutor at the same time. So the attorney general of the time said, when the decision came up to the cabinet, the attorney general of the time said, well, before we go to this motion about me, I need to read you the list of cabinet ministers who are under suspicion for an investigation and cannot participate in this vote because of a conflict of interest.
So is the attorney general supposed to be appointed by the prime minister? Or
it's supposed to be appointed by the cabinet, but it's a complicated process. And what they managed to do is they inserted legal advisors everywhere and created this culture where the legal advisors actually holds veto power about ministerial policy.
In your article, you talked about, I think it was written in February, but you had talked about how Netanyahu was basically having to go to court like 3 days a week, even at a time when Israel's at war. So what are they going after Netanyahu on?
Well, the indictments are collapsing in court now. They are, it's very hard to describe. I'll try to summarize. One of them is, the easiest one to explain is the champagne and cigars one, and the Bugs Bunny doll, which allegedly got presents in an inordinate amount from billionaire friends, Arnon Milchen and Packard and they came up with this indictment saying it's hundreds of thousands of shekels. It's like hundreds of thousands of dollars too. And then apparently it turned out they have no evidence. There is no evidence except the memory of a secretary of Arnon Milchen's, who is really anti-Bibi. And apparently she updated the numbers as the police were not happy with the volume. And they can't prove that. And then there was the question of bribery in the form of positive coverage, which is unprecedented. You know, Alan Dershowitz said this will criminalize all relations between journalists and politicians, which is always some quid pro quo.
Right.
And then they couldn't prove that case because it began with saying that this website, nobody treats it seriously. It's a news website called Walla. It offered positive coverage in return for regulatory favors for the company of the owner of both, Walla and that telecommunications company. Well, it turned out the coverage was actually hostile. So they switched to, instead of positive coverage, it was unusual responsiveness to request to change the coverage, because the coverage was more positive of other politicians. And then there was supposed to be a meeting where Netanyahu took the director general of the communications ministry and told him to give favors to this other, regulatory favors to this other company. So you see the quid pro quo.
Right.
And apparently they didn't even check. And by triangulating cell phones, the defense proved that the meeting could not have occurred. He was never there. And then it turned out that all the regulatory favors were passed through all the regulators in the bureaucracy. No one raised a flag. So the minister only had to sign it in the end. The minister was, Netanyahu is also minister of communication. So that's falling apart. This is the only bribery case in the whole affair.
So how did the deep state, as you call it, how did they react when President Trump, I think it was a couple weeks ago, he tweeted out that they need to stop the witch hunt in Israel? And it was the lead up to this week with.
Well, they did not react, and at least on the face of it, you know, they don't answer to the President of the United States. They haven't been threatened personally with any sanctions, and so they can be defined. But it changed the atmosphere, because what happened is, this is so crazy. The story I told you now is so crazy, and the fact that they drag him to court three times a week when he has to run a war.
Right.
And they set a trap for him. They said, well, if you should quit because of the trial. And he said, the law doesn't force me to quit. And I said, well, it will interfere with your doing your job. And he said, no, I can do my job. And so now if he says, no, I can't do my job because I have to run the war, they say, well, you ought to quit then. So they're waiting for that trap to close. And Netanyahu is just, you know, it's like Gulliver and these Lilliputians are trying to tie him down with ridiculous ideas about why does he have to come three times a week? Now it's, I think, two times a week.
Yeah.
Why? Because it's the public interest to finish this trial quickly. So the schedule of the judges is more important than running the war. Is this how you understand the public interest? So what Trump helped do is remind us how ridiculous this situation, which we've gotten used to, is, because Netanyahu takes it in stride. You know, he doesn't scream and shout. He criticizes them, but he's a gentleman.
You know Bibi personally. You've mentioned you went on a walk with him, and you had him on your podcast recently. Michael Oren had a paragraph in a recent column about just how he was the perfect man for the job that Israel has right now or needs. How do you think he is as a leader? He's been a prime minister longer than anyone else in Israel's history. Yeah. And just knowing him personally, and we've had a lot to say over the years about President Trump's unique courage to fight all those forces you were just describing. What is it about Bibi Netanyahu that you think just keeps him going and fighting for Israel?
His willpower is unbelievable against external forces, against internal forces, and with no credit. He's being demonized here. His family has been attacked viciously, personally, by these people. They've made his life hell. And since the bureaucracy supports the anti-Netanyahu demonstrations and so forth, they made his private life hell. These people shout outside his window constantly at all times. But I think he had, his life's mission was Iran. And he has now been vindicated in a way that would put him in history books with few other Jewish leaders over millennia, because he has been, he sees it, you know. One of his many enemies once told me, he said, you know, Netanyahu, when he shaves in the morning, he thinks he sees Moses in the mirror. It's his job to lead the people of Israel across the Red Sea. And he said this derogatively, but I don't think Netanyahu thinks about this in a caricature. He truly thinks that the Jewish people is, as always, in existential danger, and it's now up to him. It's on his shoulders now to carry it to safety across this abyss. And he has been warning about the Iran nuclear program for 40 years now, and he's been ridiculed for it, and he's been attacked for it, and people have sabotaged his policies, and he never lost sight of that guiding star, and he did it. And if you, it's almost, you know, like a Greek drama. It's from the worst nadir of October 7. He rose up from the ashes. This is a calamity that leaders usually don't survive. Mm-hmm. And he rose from the ashes, And he saw the forces at play against a very hostile American administration who was basically appeasing Iran.
Right.
He managed to turn the levers in such a way that in the end, he struck Iran and the head of this terrorist octopus that it was engulfing the Middle East because of the Obama policy and then the Biden policy. And if you and this is just it's stunning, because on the second day of the war, he said, we are going to change the geopolitics of the Middle East. And that was terrorists were still roaming around the Western Negev, and we were all dumbfounded. It was like a mega 9/11. We were just people were in complete shock, and he saw clearly. And this is, you know, the deep state here. They're all peaceniks. They're all the Oslo two-statists, and everybody understood on that side. I mean, the Biden administration, mm-hmm. the Israeli left, the Israeli press, all these forces understood that this could be a fatal blow to the idea of a Palestinian state. And everything they did since was to try and leave the door open for a Palestinian state. Mm-hmm. And in order to do this, you have to prevent victory in Gaza. So you had a brass of the IDF refusing to do the bidding of the cabinet to which they answer, and instead just bypassing their orders by raids instead of occupying territories. And I think that what Blinken thought, Secretary Blinken, and what these people thought in Israel, including the permanent, you know, they try to do a color revolution here with the financing the protest and everything. What they thought is, they thought about this as Yom Kippur exactly 5 years, almost to the day, off by one day of the 50 years from Yom Kippur, from the Yom Kippur War. Blinken saw himself as Kissinger, and Kissinger's strategy was to help Egypt save face so that not being crushed by Israel, it could then make concessions at the negotiating table. And they thought of Hamas as if Hamas was like Anwar Nasser and could be turned around, or the Palestinians could be turned around to a historical compromise, while what we saw were atrocities on a scale that instinctively clarify that these people are Nazis. You cannot make deals with them. This is not Anwar Sadat. This is not Egypt. And if they are not defeated, if Yihyeh Sinwar, as Biden tried to force us to have, if Yihyeh Sinwar would emerge from a tunnel with a V sign, he would be Saladin for the next 1,000 years. And our blood would be in the water. And all these stronger forces around us, including the Iran proxies, would just be lurking, perched over Israel, ready to pounce. And what Netanyahu managed to do patiently against all these forces that were trying to shut down the war, including the horrendous campaign, Bring Them Home Now, which is nice to have outside Israel. But in Israel, it's not like, let my people go. It's not pointing at Hamas who holds them. It's bring them home. It's directed at our government, at weakening our government, at the negotiations table, because Hamas knows there's a force here telling Netanyahu to make more and more concessions. So all these forces were arrayed around him to stop the war. And he managed to bring it like in a swing from Gaza to Lebanon to Syria and all the way to Tehran, and in the end finish that job. And that is absolutely amazing. I think he's way too sensitive about the hostages. We can't let these deals are bleeding us dry, and we need to finish off Gaza. And that's his weak spot. His detractors say he's indifferent to the suffering of the hostages. I think he's too sensitive to that's the only case where his considerations are not absolutely rational and on the mark. And I've heard it said of some American Secretary of State, or was it a National Security Advisor? But then I heard it was apocryphal, so I won't name a name. Who, in a case of hostages, the families came to the White House and said, we want to speak to the president. And the advisor said, The president is not speaking to hostage families because we don't want him to be influenced by emotions in this attempt to make rational decisions. And we don't have that here. Yeah. We are too much like a family. And when we had one hostage for which we paid with more than 1,000 terrorists, everybody called him our child. He was our child, and not just his parents' child. And this, the base of it is a good thing. Solidarity is a great thing here, mm-hmm. but you can have a situation in which private pain is going to completely overrule national interest when these are existential questions.
Right.
If we surrender to Hamas, we will not be able to live here. The state of Israel would not exist 20 years from now if we don't finish this job.
Let's talk about surrendering to Hamas or Hamas surrendering to Israel. What is you mentioned a total victory. I mean, what does that, in your mind, what does a total victory over Hamas mean?
It means surrender of all Hamasniks, return of all our hostages, complete disarmament. And if they return our hostages, they may get a safe passage. This can only be achieved by siege and occupation. And this is what the army keeps refusing to do.
Right.
Because our deep states,
right,
and our jurists have an interpretation of international law that far exceeds all caution described in the Pentagon's manual for conducting wars. Siege is actually a preferred way to conduct a war. It brings less bloodshed. And what Israel should do is divide Gaza into areas, circle each one of them, leave a corridor for humanitarian evacuation. Everyone that's not armed can leave. And then whoever stays is an enemy. Not a drop of water, not a slice of bread, not a drop of gas, until you come out with your hands over your head and give us all our hostages. That would be the best way to return the hostages and the way to bring to defeat Hamas completely.
So when President Trump says he's meeting with Bibi this week, when he says that we think we can get a deal with Gaza this week, I'm taking it that you don't want that to happen at all.
Not at all. Not at all. And I hope Netanyahu has showed that when it comes to the vital interests of Israel, he can say no to an American president. He has before. And I hope that if that's the deal on the table, that he will say no. We don't know if that's the deal. The plan for relocation is great. If it includes relocation for the for a large number of Gazans who want to leave, and if we have a way to verify that all Hamasniks will be rooted out, then that's fine. But the problem is Hamas is embedded in a population. And this is why I don't see anything short of an occupation completely rooting them out. Because we need to do what Germany did with denazification and what Japan did under MacArthur. We need total surrender to start with, and then their school curricula is everything is about killing Jews, and this is not just Hamas. This is the Palestinian Authority. All these terrorists of October 7, they were brought up on school books that the Palestinian Authority produces, not Hamas. And these school books just teach you that killing Jews is your highest duty. And when you have like a grammar exercise, they teach you the spelling of a sentence that say, it is forbidden to think of the enemy as human. So they drill this into your head from age 3. You play games in which you kill Israeli soldiers. And we need to completely change the whole system of education, the whole clerical class that is teaching wild anti-Semitism, all this has to be rooted out or the problem will return. And we also need to make sure that no arms enter Gaza, complete yep. embargo.
On a much larger scale, obviously, with respect to Iran, you had the 12-day war, the U.S. got involved for the strike on the nuclear facilities. How much damage, that obviously isn't a total surrender on the part of the mullahs, but how much damage do you think that 12-day war did on Iran?
Well, I can't comment on the actual facilities and what it did to them. If they start from scratch, they can still do it again. So there's no rooting it out finally and completely in the technical sense. But I think that it did more than that. It humbled Iran. And what we need to strive for is a situation as close as we can to that in Lebanon, where we have freedom of action. And we should make it clear that all this will happen again if you start your nuclear program again. This is a very, very strong statement, because look at what we are facing now in the Middle East. We were under the shadow of this menacing force with all its proxies and hundreds of thousands of rockets. And now we have complete freedom of flight over Tehran. We can take out anyone we want. We penetrated them so deep. I'm not sure about all the details. And sometimes Mossad PR are almost as good as Mossad operations. So you never know what they actually did. But allegedly, at least, what we know is that they penetrated the secret networks of the operatives, and they called them to a meeting where they were all killed together, because that was the depth of the penetration. So we demonstrated that we are not to be messed with, and that we would go to very long lengths. And if you look at what happened, and if you look at Arab commentators, they say Israel, after October 7, it managed to do all that. So imagine what it would be if it started from a level plane.
Yeah.
And I hope now that there would be a deep change also in our army. Because look at what happened to us. The people treating Gaza were all Oslo peaceniks, and they never suspected. So there was a huge invasion of thousands of terrorists, and we had no clue. While in Tehran, when Khamenei sneezes, we know where he puts his handkerchief. And so that is Mossad, and this is Shabak and Tzal and the IDF. And Shabak and Tzal and the IDF have become postmodern. And there's actually in the literature about what the culture of armies, there's a theorist named Moskos who defines what a postmodern army is. They think in political rather than military terms. Instead of defeat, they have such ideas as imprinting an image on the enemy's mind, and they tend to defensive war instead of offensive war. And that, for us, the Ben-Gurion, the original theory of defense is that we seek our enemies outside our borders. So, and what happened to us in recent years is we're hiding under Iron Dome,
right,
behind a Slari wall. We are patrolling a border, and we haven't learned the lessons of millennia of warfare,
right,
that there is no such thing as an unbreachable wall. The wall of China, the Maginot Line, the Hitler's Atlantic Wall were all breached, because when you develop a routine behind a wall, the enemy would study your routine and would find out where you have become negligent or numb, and at that point they will strike. And so we should get back our stamina and start. Henry Kissinger once said that only Israelis speak of peace in religious terms like redemption. It's the end of days. And peace, he said, is just a temporary truce between states to find their common interests. That's all. And we thought of peace as that end of history, Fukuyama's end of history, and attached messianic hopes to it. And our generals all became peaceniks. They all became pro-Oslo. And we should remember that in and this is why Trump is a partner to Bibi. We should remember that there's a book by Tom Cotton called Only the Strong. Peace is achieved through strength and deterrence. And in a rough neighborhood, you can't go the Obama way of the, you know, community organizer from Chicago, where you hug the bully until they become your friend. No. If the bully hits you, you hit him 10 times as hard, disproportionately, so that next time nobody else messes with you. Now, before all this started, I wrote a book about late night after hours clubs and the gray area between crime and just seedy clubs. And so I had a lot of chats with bouncers. And they said, you know, on Allenby Street, that's the name of the book, it's the name of a street here in Allenby where the police were mostly absent. He said, if you're a bouncer and someone touches you, you can't arrest them. You have to teach them a lesson in such a way that you make an example of them for everyone else. So he said in a picturesque way, if you smack him on the face, you hurt his ego and he'll come back with five friends. If you break his knee, he will have a few months in rehab in a hospital in order to consider if he wants to mess with you again. So the wisdom of bouncers is also the wisdom of statesmen in the Middle East. And I think Trump and Netanyahu share this. Deterrence is the key to lasting, if not peace, then at least non-belligerence.
You talk about what Trump and Netanyahu share in common. What about the all the negotiations, Steve Witkoff, and you know the fact that he wants to make a deal that with whether it's Gaza or Qatar or I mean, just yesterday he said about Iran that they're no longer bullies. I mean, you just used the term bully, and I think Huckabee was there and kind of smiled at his Jewish counterparts across the table, because I don't think anyone from Israel thinks that they're no longer bullies.
And I think, you know, Americans, since their virtue and what I love about them is their pragmatic way to look at life, saying, you know, if there are two opposing points, there is a middle somewhere. And that's not always true. It's true if you live in the same culture, but there's no middle between people for whom the greatest religious obligation for which they're willing to sacrifice their children is killing Jews and us who want to live. There's no halfway killing Jews to satisfy everyone, so you can't make a deal with Nazis. And I think Witkoff is an example of that. And Netanyahu is not, and I don't know where Trump is, but you know, Netanyahu and Trump fooled everyone.
Yeah.
They created this sense of a rift. They used the hostile press. The press here was gleeful. Netanyahu has been shown his place. Now Trump will turn his... Now he also lost Trump. And the head of the opposition, Yair Lapid, was screaming from the podium, you have ruined the relationships with... You've lost Trump. And Netanyahu was sitting in his seat in the parliament. And he said, and he did this. And Lapid did not understand what was coming because they were planning Iran. Already at that stage. So I think that the cooperation between these two leaders is unprecedented. And I just saw the clip of how Trump welcomed Netanyahu waiting on the curb, turning to the press with a cheeky smile that I interpret as saying, here are your predictions. And, So I think that, you know, if there are disagreements, there's also great friendship. And I think there's also understanding because of the legal trouble they both had and the relations with the press. They use the press here. They use the press. The gleeful press here helped numb the Iranians. The press here was declaring how the relation was ruined and Iran just bought it and they went to sleep. All these scientists who were killed in their beds later. But also, if you look at the relations with the press vis-a-vis the deep state, then you see they suffered the same predicament in a sense that what happened to the press, and this is why, you know, you have a podcast, I have a podcast, we are the future, the alternative, because what happened to the legacy media is instead of being the watchdog of democracy, they became the attack dogs of the prosecution. And what happened is, this will be studied in history books, because the weaponization of the criminal law in both cases, the Russian collusion hoax and the Netanyahu trials, we think of the press as supplicants of the prosecution, over the FBI and the opposition. But that's misleading, because these investigations were not meant to produce evidence for a criminal trial or an impeachment. They were meant to produce leaks for a political hit. And therefore, it's not that the press has been working for the FBI. It's that the FBI became the investigative arm of a dirty press. That's what happened here too. Every night, bombshell leaks from the Netanyahu investigations.
Right.
So they were producing leaks. They were not producing evidence, and they never thought they would get to court. They thought Netanyahu would go for a plea deal, that he would resign, that he would somewhere give up in the middle of the process. They just picked up the wrong guy.
Do you feel like the 12-day war, as President Trump calls it, do you feel like Israel was pressured to stop that that effort?
I think so. I would have liked a few more days, but if the price would have been a non-intervention by the United States, look, this is a crucial thing. It was just a single strike, basically, or a few strikes in one fell swoop, right. But it demonstrated to the whole region the alliance between Israel and America,
yep.
Its strength, and also that the United States is again willing to use force, because the reliance on the Obama appeasement mentality was what turned this region into a wild thing. And Trump understands this. He hit Qasem Soleimani in his first term in office, and he understands you don't need to put boots on the ground everywhere, but you need to demonstrate that you are willing to fight. And I heard this from Mike Pompeo on my podcast when I interviewed him after Biden won the elections. And I asked him, what's the difference between the policy of the outgoing Trump administration and the Obama administration before it? And he said three things. One, Iran is the problem, not the solution. Second, you need to bypass the Palestinian veto over Arab-Israeli negotiations. And third, you need a credible threat of force in the region. And I think Trump has returned that trio. And we see when such a president is in the White House, the region is and will be peaceful. When there's a peacenik in the White House, there will be war.
Gadi, thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous. It's great to meet you. And I'll be following you from this point forward.
Same here. A pleasure. Thank you very much.